Time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It's the end of an era for Mac Incorporated, which serves senior citizens. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. There's no doubt that we are about to see an explosion of retirees, with the baby boomers beginning to turn 65 just 5 years ago in 2011. And they are living longer. 1900 men had a life expectancy of 48. By the year 2000, it jumped to 74. And looking ahead to 2050, women are expected to make it to 86. Men come in at 80. Here on the Eastern Shore, Mac Incorporated has become an institution for seniors, whose acronym stands for Maintaining Active Citizens. Peggy Bradford has been at the helm as executive director for 37 years. But she's retiring this year, and we have her in our studios. Welcome to the program, first of all.
Thank you. I am so thrilled to be here with you and your listeners this morning.
So was this something, a decision that you had been planning on, or what's the background here?
The background is, well, for years I told myself if I ever got caught up, I could think about retirement, and the reality came that you'll never catch up. But I think some of the impetus came from the completion of the construction of an educational wing to our facility in Salisbury, along with the understanding that our agency was in good shape, was growing rapidly, but you know, things were stable, and now was probably a good time for change.
So now you've been there a very long time. And as I just mentioned a moment ago, the baby boomers are just beginning to retire. That was about 5 years ago. Over that period of time, what kinds of changes have you seen in terms of the elderly, their needs, the characteristics that perhaps were different when you started this this journey at Mac and now when you retire?
Well, I think you've identified one of the key things that's happening in our community as well as in our country, but particularly so here on the Eastern Shore. And that's the impact of the demographics, the aging of the baby boomers. Baby boomers were the largest number of people ever born in the history of the world. So those are people born between 1945 and 1965. So it's a baby boomer's age. They have brought changes in each and every generation they've been through. Here on the shore, it's fastest growing population that we have. And we also need to understand that not only are people aging on the shore, they're moving here, they're retiring here. So we have an influx of retirees, an aging of the population. Unfortunately, we have seen out-migration of younger people. There are not many jobs when people finish school, and often they leave the shore to find better job opportunities. So if you think at it from a point of view of aging, these are your caregivers for a whole generation that's not there, yeah, or people who have moved here and left their caregivers behind. So that's put a real strain on the resources of those of us who provide services to the elderly. To give you an idea, when I started out, 1979, we served about 4,000 Meals on Wheels a year. This year, we'll serve somewhere between 70 and 75,000 and could serve many more because of the increase in need and the growth in population. So that's just one of many changes that we've seen.
So, I mean, one of the things that obviously face people, particularly as they get older, because we are getting older, we're seeing a lot more illnesses and conditions that perhaps we might not have seen in the past. I mean, heart disease, for example, is now high. Cancer is all high. But in part, that's because we've lived longer. Now, I understand that. I think I saw one where cancer could actually fall down further, and Alzheimer's may very well begin to move up because we're seeing more of those incidents. Those kinds of conditions, how do they affect the elderly in terms of that lifespan? And what should we be thinking about in terms of those are some of the roadblocks that we might run into as we get older? I mean, I remember seeing an ad the other day about a woman who says, well, she's in her early 60s and she has a long life to live, right? I think you've probably seen the ad. And my question is, well, maybe not so, or maybe this is going to be a lot different than she thinks.
Well, we all want that ideal. I'm going to be healthy till the day I die.
Right.
That's not the reality. The reality is that, you know, one in five of us, if we live to be late 70s, 80s, we'll probably be faced with some kind of dementia, you know, Alzheimer's type dementia. You know, what kind of plans do we have in place for our care? I just told you about the problem associated with who's going to take care of us. Often we see one frail spouse struggling to care for another spouse. Children live somewhere away, so they turn to agencies like MAC for help. And I can tell you our resources, Don, over the year, particularly our state and federal funding, has not increased. In many cases, it's decreased. So you have increased population with needs, decreased funding. This has been a very generous and supportive community, things like the Community Foundation, United Way, private foundations and donors have really helped us fill the plug. So there's a cost to care, and somebody has to provide it. I think if you've been looking at Salisbury University, we've been working with Beacon on a Grayshore initiative, looking just at that, the impact an aging population has here on the Eastern Shore.
I know, for instance, I was looking at it. I mean, I think it's like round-the-clock home care, if you were to pay for something like about $150,000 a year. Assisted living, minimum probably about $4,000. I experienced that, although sometimes it can go up as much as $6,000 a month. And obviously, it's not covered by Medicare. Medicaid will kick in once you reach a certain level in terms of your resources. What kind of impact does that have? I mean, it's, and my own personal experience, it doesn't seem like there's some centralized operation. I know MAC tries to do what it can, but there seems to be sort of scattered shot. You're trying to figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. And what about that?
Yeah, well, if once again, you put your finger on another key thing is sort of the changes in healthcare. You're seeing a big drive towards community-based services. Nursing home admissions, nursing home beds, the number is decreasing. Hospital stays, you're lucky if you get to spend the night. You know, it's almost drive-through now. The goal is to provide services in the community outside of acute care facilities, outside of long-term care facilities. And MAC services have really changed to meet those demands. We do provide case management services to frail, low-income older persons who would be eligible for nursing home admission, and we help obtain services for them to enable them to stay in their own home, because that's where your quality of life is by and large. We all want to age in our own home, you know, not in an institution. MAC also, at the other end of the spectrum, has really, really expanded its services, not only here on the Lower Shore, but statewide through our new Living Well Center of Excellence, where we offer many evidence-based health programs designed to help people manage their chronic conditions. We partner with 11 different hospital systems in the state, locally PRMC and Atlantic General Hospital, to keep people as healthy as long as possible. So currently we're working with PRMC on with individuals who are cancer survivors, people who have diabetes, people who are managing multiple chronic illnesses. And we found that these partnerships are working for both of us. Some of the programs we offer are Stanford University programs that have proven to help people manage their illnesses, reduce hospital stays, reduce returns to the emergency room. So that's the other part of the picture, is let's keep us healthy and let's try to provide the services we need to those people who are not healthy, who are frail and need that assistance. It's quite a balancing act.
Now, one of the things that was looking at was, and a lot of things that we are concerned about when we get older is our cognitive abilities to remember, for example, or maybe we get distracted. There are a whole set of things that come into play, to say nothing about, obviously, our vision begins mm-hmm. to go, and hopefully we have glasses and other things that'll keep that and stay, as well as, of course, people just having difficulty hearing. I mean, how does one manage those kinds of things as they begin to begin to happen?
Well, one thing I would encourage people to do is to visit the Mac office. Mac's office is located in Salisbury, Maryland, 909 Progress Circle. It's off Snow Hill Road. Mac is co-located with this disability partner, the Bay Area Center for Independent Living. And we are a designated aging and disability resource center. What that means is anybody who requires information about services or where to go or needs assistance with any type of disability or health impairment, whether it be failing vision, hearing, memory loss, come visit us. We have a showroom. The Bay Area Center for Independent Living has a showroom full of all sorts of gizmos and gadgets designed to help you remain independent. For example, there are probably 20 different types of telephones for almost anything you can think of. If you're hearing impaired, they have telephones designed for people who are hearing impaired. If you have memory problems, they have phones with where you can put pictures of someone. So instead of trying to remember a number, you press the picture. You have all sorts of visual aids for people with arthritis to help them continue to function when they have problems grasping things. And we work very closely with the Bay Area Center for Independent Living, and we will walk an individual coming in from our office to their office or vice versa. Whichever organization has the service, we want to make sure they get a warm handoff to that organization. So there are things out there to help you live independently.
Well, because a lot of us, we want to live as independently as possible mm-hmm. until to that last moment, as it were. How important is that? I mean, so I read some of the literature suggests work as long as you can, for example. It may not be the job that you mm-hmm. had during your life, but nonetheless, that it brings some kind of dignity and some kind of independence. Mm-hmm. Is that the best approach, you think, if you're able to go out or maybe even volunteer?
Meaningful engagement in your community or in your family, your church, whatever, I think is essential to your overall well-being. Too often we see people retire. They flop back in that lazy boy, and then you have a general decline. Although I must say, we have a new group of people here on the shore, folks who have moved here, retired here, folks with a substantial amount of income who have become entrepreneurs, started new businesses. I mean, you don't want to retire to nothing. You want to find something that will provide meaning to you and your life. Because if you pull yourself out of society, then I think you're going to look forward to depression, general health decline. By the way, depression is a major issue among older people, particularly older men who retire.
Oh yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, and what is it just a matter of getting them back into doing things, or is there something more to it? I mean, is in terms of depression.
I think, some late life depression is indeed related to all the things that happen to you in late life, which may be loss of a spouse, loss of job, loss of health. So many losses and how you cope with them. But generally for men, their work has had such a major focus in their life. You take that out of the picture, they're not quite sure which way to go.
Now, is there also, is there a tendency late in life to repair relationships with families and friends, or does that go by the wayside? What, I mean, do people withdraw? What happens with that? And how important is that in terms of reconnecting?
Oh, relationships are key. We need to have a relationship with, as I said, our community, our friends, our families. We see people coming to our senior center who have lost a spouse or families live away. They've become morose and in some cases clinically depressed. And within 2 or 3 weeks, they have reconnected with a network. And it's like better than any pill you can give somebody is that meaningful relationship with a group of persons. So that indeed that's a key factor and to aging successfully.
Yeah, now the other side of this, of course, is the caregiver, and a lot of us are experiencing that more and more. Where it's, I think it's just said to my parents that, you know, they raised me and took care of me, and then suddenly there I was having to take care of them. What kinds of things would you? Well, how significant is that in terms of the amount of time that say spouses or family members or children are spending? In terms, I think I saw one figure said something like 19 hours a week in some cases.
That's you're probably 20 hours a week too.
Yeah.
That's
like a part-time job.
Indeed. About 5 years ago, MAC established a caregiver resource center to support not only family caregivers but professional caregivers. We see all sorts of caregivers. Some folks are struggling to care for aging parents while they still have children of their own. Call those folks kind of the sandwich generation.
Right.
They're sort of sandwiched between two generations. You know, who'd I give attention to today? Others are trying to care for a spouse. Certainly I have been through the caregiving things with parents and with a stepfather who had dementia. You have long-distance caregivers. MAC often gets calls from family members who say, you know, I'm living in Pennsylvania, California, whatever. My mother's in Salisbury. What can you do? How can you help? You usually get the calls after holidays. Kids come home on holidays. And that's when they find out mom and dad are not doing as well as they say they are doing. And the kids aren't there to provide the help. So they turn to organizations like ours and say, you know, how can you help? Caregiving is very, very difficult. The caregiver often puts their needs secondary.
Right.
So you see cases where... I can vividly recall a good friend caring for her husband who had cancer, and she kept refusing help. See, caregivers don't think anybody can provide care the way they can. It's probably true.
Right, to some extent.
But they need to take a break and take care of themselves. My friend ended up with a stroke. She was on one floor of the hospital. Her husband was on another floor of the hospital. Caregiving is indeed a very tough job.
One of the things I was curious about, because you were talking about the sandwiching, one of the phenomena that we're seeing in America today is that women are having kids later in life, which means that there's more of an inclination that they may very well find themselves, their kids raising their families while their parents are older. I mean, it sounds like that's something that's looming on the horizon, maybe.
It's here now.
It's here now, right?
it loomed and it came, and it's going to continue. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something that we'll see probably next 15 to 20 years. We're going to continue to see the increase in the 65 plus population, the 85 plus population, the 100 plus population, and they're all very different, you know. Age 65 to 75 is very different than age 85 to 100. And then you have 100 plus. People are 100 plus living independently. Who would think of this? Yeah, 100 years ago, you know, life expectancy age 40.
That's right, exactly. I mean, modern medicine is absolutely amazing. You mentioned, by the way, a moment ago, I think one of the most difficult things sometimes I think, is dealing with people who have dementia, that you're seeing them decline, whether it's Alzheimer's or it's other forms as well, because I saw it certainly my own parents. You had your own personal experience. What is that like, and what kind of lessons do you think you learned from that?
Oh, boy. Well, one thing, all of us, I hope every one of your listeners have advanced directives where they have a legal document that says, if thus and so happens, I want so and so to take care of my affairs. If they don't, and you have an older person who has dementia and is unable to make decisions on his or her behalf, then you're going to have to launch a whole legal procedure to be able to take charge of their affairs. If there's no powers of attorney in place, no advanced directives, because they don't have the judgment to say, hey, there's something wrong with me. In fact, it's probably quite the opposite.
Right, yes, they're saying
that's what you're going to, it's going to be denial. No, it's you. So you may have to launch a guardianship case to be appointed the legal guardian of a parent or other relatives to help them manage their affairs. Speaking of guardianship, as the director of MAC, I get appointed as a legal guardian of people over the age of 65 who have no one else who can serve, or may have had a family member or other person who has abused them financially or physically. Mm-hmm. And that is one thing we're seeing more and more of is elder abuse, financial, physical. Some of it is related to the strains of caregiving. You may have heard of the term granny dumping. Mm-hmm. That's where mother, father, grandmother, whoever gets dumped somewhere. Usually it's Friday afternoon. Some hospital emergency room. I was just talking to some colleagues yesterday. They were talking about a client they got dumped at the McDonald's.
Jeez.
You never know where folks are going to get dumped. I was recently appointed as guardian for an elderly man whose son had a friend take him to the emergency room, dump him. He said he couldn't care for him anymore. Son cleaned out the bank account and went to France.
Jeez.
And so here we have a vulnerable elderly person who needs care and has no financial resources and nobody to care for him. And that's where agencies like MAC comes in.
Do you think that's simply the strain of caregiving, or do you think there's just simple greed? Or is it both?
Both, and then I would throw in drug addiction.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Often we'll see an older person's assets depleted by a child or a grandchild who has a problem with addictions.
Mm. So what is that we mentioned a moment ago about, so what is it, how is it different, say, between ages of, say, 65 and, say, 75, as opposed to, say, 75 or 85 or 90 and then beyond? I mean, what kinds of differences are there as you kind of look ahead?
I think dealing with multiple chronic illnesses, chronic disease self-management is a major initiative that MAC has undertaken. You know, as you age, there is going to be some physical decline, no matter how hard you work on maintaining what you have.
Right.
the fact of the matter is you're going to have some physical decline, as you know, probably maybe in vision, hearing, arthritis. And the older you get, the more likely you're going to have to deal with those issues. Here on the shore, the issues that we're looking at, as you identified, is heart disease, diabetes, almost an epidemic of type 2 diabetes here on the shore, cancer, chronic lung problems, breathing problems, and all those impair your ability to do day-to-day things. And then throw in falls. Falls are probably the number one enemy of older persons. MAC just received a major 2-year grant from the federal administration on community living to do education throughout the state on falls prevention. If somebody is over the age of 65 and they have a major fall, about half those people are not going to be alive in 2 years. That's how traumatic a fall can be to your life.
So quickly, what are you going to do after this? Any ideas? do you have any plans?
Whatever am I going to do? I don't have any concrete plans except that whatever I do has to have meaning. Because having a wonderful career that's brought meaning to my life, I can't jump into a void. I'll be around. Maybe in Annapolis, people might be hearing from me advocating for the elderly.
There you go. Yeah, meaningful work and activity, I think, is the key. We've been talking with Peggy Bradford. She is the executive director of MAC, that's Maintaining Active Citizens, and she is retiring this year after 37 years. We appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us, and no doubt we will see you again.
I'm sure you will.
Thank you. This has been Don Robert Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Our human ancestors hunted and gathered. They survived and reproduced. And one day, they began to ask, why? I'm Krista Tippett. Join me on Being, spacious conversation about meaning, faith, and the immensity of 21st century lives. A journey of discovery from American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 7 on NPR News Talk 90.7 FM, putting Delmarva first.
With the talk of an ice hockey team coming to the Eastern Shore and the grand tradition of baseball in the region, this morning we're going to take a look at the impact and significance of sports in the state of Maryland. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. A George Washington University study estimated in 2014 that visitor spending nationwide for amateur sports nearly topped $9 billion. And a University of Florida report found that overall spending for just youth sports, that included traveling with children, totaled $7 billion. Back in 2008, Terry Heseltine was appointed to head the Maryland Sports, which encourages, of course, development of sporting events around the state. In addition, Steve Miller, he's the director of Wicomico County Recreation, Parks, and Tourism, and Andy Wisk, program director of the U.S. Specialty Sports Association. And welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm going to start with you, Terry, and tell me a little bit about the impact that we're seeing in terms of sports, in terms of the state of Maryland and the kind of economic impact that it has.
Well, the amateur sports market in the state of Maryland is huge. You know, as I like to say in my cliche statement, it's heads and beds, food and belly, gas and cars, credit card and cash and counters and butts and seats. It's how we measure the fabric of how people are traveling into the state. And sports happens to be the vehicle in which we deliver on the economic value. We obviously work with strategic partners throughout the entire state of Maryland. Obviously, we have a great partnership here down in Wicomico County, and also the new creation of the Mid-Atlantic Amateur Sports Alliance, which is the leader in our industry of establishing coalitions to ensure that we're maximizing the resources and the assets, you know, in various regions throughout the state. And my job is to ensure that not only our partners down here on the Lower Eastern Shore are getting the biggest value out of the opportunities that they're experiencing, but we're also part of their team to ensure that we're going out and securing other opportunities that might be out there in the marketplace. And we do that throughout the entire state. From the, you know, out in Garrett County, we hosted the ICF Canoe Slalom World Championships back in 2014. Huge event during the Olympic movement. Those are the type of activities in which we're proud to be a part of. We're really proud to be a part of the USSSA Eastern World Series, which is going on as we speak. We're also very proud to be a part of the Governor's Challenge, which is an event that was established in Wicomico County and is growing exponentially. It's the second largest holiday tournament in the country east of the Mississippi. Our goal, obviously, is to work with, you know, the team here to make it number one and then continue to grow that product. But amateur sports in the state of Maryland is huge. It's millions, it's tens of millions of dollars on direct spending in Maryland's economy. The USSSA World Series alone is a $11+ million direct spending event on Maryland's economy. So amateur sports is huge in the state of Maryland.
Andy, I'll turn to you since we're talking about your organization. So what brings you to the Eastern Shore in terms of what's attractive about the Eastern Shore?
Well, this location has the event has blossomed here because of the unique blend of the attraction, the destination in the Ocean City area, with the assets that the region as a whole has all around it, is in terms of shopping, dining, support services through recreation parks and tourism in Wicomico, Worcester counties, and Ocean City, and also all the playing fields, all of the high-quality parks that we're able to utilize for these events. It's a win-win. People are taking their children to play in these competitive tournaments, but it's also a family vacation at the same time, and this has just been the perfect formula.
What's attractive about this particular area in terms of its facilities and its infrastructure to bring you here?
Well, a big piece of that is the support that we receive. This event takes dozens of people to pull off successfully at the level of quality that we want to have, and that support is phenomenal here. The second thing, honestly, is that destination. So you can pair it with a vacation, and not to be forgotten is the proximity to major metropolitan areas, where you're a single day drive distance, a very reasonable drive distance from, I believe, about 25% of the nation's population, and you don't have to get on a plane to go somewhere to be a part of the event. You can pack the family in the minivan and come on down.
So I know it's Steve Miller, who's with Wicomico County Recreation Parks and Tourism. What does an event like this mean in terms of Wicomico County?
It means a lot. I mean, Terry mentioned the direct spend for this event alone is over $11 million. When you look at the overall landscape of tourism in Wicomico County, the events we run, last year we ran over 50 events. The economic impact was over $53 million. And when you look at isolate sports marketing from that, it's about 80 to 85% of our book of business. And UCCSA, this World Series, is a big chunk of that. So when you look at it from the terms of hotels and restaurants and local business, you've got thousands of people coming into town for this three-week stretch. It's huge for our community. It's huge for the region, as Terry mentioned, not just here in Wicomico, but across the region. It's huge.
When a major sporting event comes to, say, an area like this, and we'll take, like, for instance, the USSSA, are there special preparations that you have to make or special things you have to do? How does that kick in?
Yeah, it's become so big that it's almost become a year-round preparation. I mean, we really start our planning and execution back in October and November. Certainly as it leads up and gets closer, there's any number of things between preparing facilities and sites to actually host the games, to behind-the-scenes work of planning of opening ceremonies, to program books, to any number of things. So it's, Andy mentioned, it takes dozens of people. We've got one of the strengths of our department is we are recreation, parks, tourism, civic centers, all one. And I don't know a single person in our organization that doesn't have some level of involvement with this event. And it takes everybody to pull this thing off.
We even had Steve raking fields the other day after some rain.
I see. Well, chief operator and bottle washer is at the...
Absolutely. Whatever it takes to get it done.
That's right. Well, let me ask you this, Terry. So as I've been reading it, some of the overall sports, particularly amateur sports, is down in terms of traveling and so on. On the other hand, it seems as if what we're looking at is a lot of niche kind of sporting, whether it's gymnastics, obviously with softball, lacrosse, rugby. There seems to be, instead of, say, a couple of major sporting events, that there seems to be sort of this isolated niche kind of thing that's going on.
Well, the sports tourism, the sports event industry is ever evolving. You know, sports that you mentioned, obviously, on that list, throw in something like Quidditch, for example, the Harry Potter craze. You know, that national championship last year down in Florida had 3,500 teams in Orlando. So things like Quidditch are taking off. Disc golf and frisbee golf and ultimate frisbee, for example. We're looking at an event right now here on the Lower Eastern Shore that has field ultimate frisbee, and then we're also creating an idea for a beach version of that same sport. So whatever we can do to cultivate an opportunity that brings people to town to have a positive world-class experience, we're going to explore it. And you mentioned numbers down. You know, certain sports numbers are down, but certain sports numbers are growing. Lacrosse is still one of the fastest growing sports in the United States. And it's a sport that is just kind of penetrating. You obviously, Salisbury University has a tremendous lacrosse program, but when it comes to the tournaments and those aspects that are happening, you know, Wicomico County, Worcester, and Ocean City are really just revving up the potential there in the lacrosse market. We obviously know that, you know, this area does a great job with softball. You know, Andy sitting here in the USSSA tournament, you know, that's many years of evolution going on. So our job is to find the right niche things that fit the community, that the community can rally around and make a really value points on, and give those athletes and those parents and families that come into town a world-class experience and a world-class visitor experience. And that's what Steve and his team do to ensure that every visitor that comes through this market has that that opportunity. And our job is to ensure that type of white glove treatment that happens down here to these events carries through our entire state of Maryland. And we have other partners throughout the state that do a tremendous job as well. But your leaders in the sports industry really are right here in Wicomico County through the and through the MASA initiative. So we're very fortunate that we have industry driving leaders right here, and they're doing that world-class white glove treatment for all the spectators, fans, and attendees that come.
Are there any areas, by the way, the city that say, or the state rather, that are say more attracted to one particular kind of sport as opposed to another? What do you find?
Well, for example, if you come down the I-95 corridor, you're dealing with a lot of your traditional soccer, lacrosse, football, you know, those type of activities, because when you talk about the logistics between New York to Washington, D.C., they're looking for the quick exit strategy. And those what you're seeing there is a lot shorter turn on events, with the exception of those three-day weekends. For example, over Memorial Day weekend this last year, we had a youth soccer tournament, the SAC Memorial Day tournament, that had over 700 teams participate over a three-day weekend. That's a $10 million economic generation for the central part of the state. It uses five counties worth of hotel properties, five counties worth of fields to make that event happen. But where the advantage there in the central part is right off that I-95 corridor over holiday weekend. And so they can, you know, maximize that opportunity. Where what you have down here on the Lower Eastern Shore is a tremendous opportunity to create that experience in that destination. You have the beachfront property in Ocean City coming through with all the amenities, you know, through the gut of Worcester and Wicomico County, which makes it an ideal competitive set when we go out and compete at the national level to secure these events. This is one of the most competitive industries out there in the tourism industry right now, because since I started in this industry almost 20-something years ago, over 470 communities and or cities across the country have established a sports division to sell sports and to recruit sports. So what they're doing down here on the Lower Eastern Shore through MASA and being creative with inventory assets is setting a trend in the industry, and I'm very proud that Maryland Sports is a part of that.
And so I'll ask the same question about what do you see in terms of specialty sports, the kind of sports that we're looking at? Are there trends in that? And what kinds, are there particular areas, particularly the state, for instance, that you've been looking at that attract one thing as opposed to another?
Well, my particular office is focused on girls fast pitch softball.
Right, right.
Our association is actually the largest multi-sport governing body in the United States, offering 10 different sports, your traditional ones, as well as things like taekwondo and golf and things like that. But we were founded as a bat and ball organization, and that's our bread and butter. Slow pitch, adult slow pitch, youth fast pitch, and baseball. We're actually the largest baseball organization in the country. We are working to cultivate baseball in the region, both on the Eastern Shore and the Western Shore, because USSSA has a virtual zero share in the state of Maryland right now. And that's just due to turnover in leadership with that particular sport. But as far as your governing bodies go, there's a governing body for every little niche that's out there. And for USSSA to be the softball people, there's a Quidditch group and there's a handball group, and you know, you name it, and every one of them has, you know, a world-class national championship of some sort that they hang their hat on. And whether they're drawing 30 people that are having the time of their lives or 3,000 people that are having the time of their lives, That's the culminating event for that particular group.
Because one of the things you mentioned about particularly the Eastern Shore, the Eastern Shore has this great baseball tradition. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously we have the Shorebirds, but if you look at going back in time, there are a lot of towns that had all these small baseball teams. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can go to the little museum and see them. And matter of fact, I've talked to some of the folks who now play old-time baseball, which is much different than modern baseball, to say the least, including the fact that the ball can bounce and you can catch it and still get somebody out. But that's another issue. And you can get somebody out by throwing the ball at him, too. Mm-hmm. So, but why is it that there isn't this, that just hasn't worked for you guys yet? And are there plans to try to pull that in?
Yeah, it's there's with turnover of leadership with several governing bodies that have battled over the last decade for the market share here, it's become very fragmented. There's plenty of baseball being played. There's baseball almost every weekend here on Delmarva and certainly on the Western Shore. It's a matter of kind of bringing everybody together under one banner. And my organization, USSSA, is advancing some technological things with our website, with player stat tracking, with scouting, things like that, that eventually are going to make their way into softball as well, but started with baseball, that we're hoping to partner up with these independent groups and be able to take their program to the next level, while at the same time grow that partnership, bring them together, and make them part of our family.
So in terms of Wicomico County, what kinds of sports are you looking to attract? I mean, how successful have you been in the sports that you have been bringing? Mm-hmm. Obviously, softball's one of them. But what other sports are you looking at? What seems to be successful, not successful?
Where our wheelhouse has been, as Andy mentioned, in the bat and ball sports, particularly with softball, men's slow-pitch softball and also girls' fast-pitch softball, that's really been our wheelhouse. Where we're really looking to expand, I think there are opportunities, as Andy mentioned, in baseball. We've made some progress in the last couple of years with different folks that are running baseball tournaments, so certainly that's an area of growth. Basketball, Terry mentioned the Governor's Challenge basketball tournament is now one of the largest holiday basketball tournaments in the country. That's growing, and as a result of that, we're getting spinoff. This past summer, we had a brand new spinoff event from the Governor's Challenge. We also hosted the AAU under-8 national tournament, which was a boys basketball event. So we're starting now to, I think, get a reputation in the sport of basketball. And then we're constantly looking, Terry mentioned lacrosse. We're looking to expand in those types of things. And even the niche things, we're one of the finalists for the Quidditch regional. So we're looking at those niche opportunities in volleyball and different things that, honestly, we're open to any opportunity. But the large part of our success has been softball, but we're making inroads in other sports as well.
But describe Quidditch for me.
Well, that's a tough one. So actually, Quidditch, if you're familiar with the Harry Potter, it's right. the sport there, and I'm no expert by any means, but they literally have a broom between their legs, and they've modified from the book a game, and it's a field game where they'll run with the broom and throw the quaffle, I guess it is, and it's very entertaining. I have to say, I watched at Salisbury University, they have a club team, and I went down, watched a practice, was very entertained. It seemed very very engaging for the participants, and certainly for the fans. It's something unique and something I would really like to see here. I think people would get a kick out of it.
Yeah. Are you going to promote that?
We are definitely going to promote that. I know through the Mid-Atlantic Amateur Sports Alliance initiative, you know, I know the mayor in Ocean City is very high on Quidditch. It's unique. It's, you know, when you talk about initiative like the Mid-Atlantic Amateur Sports Alliance, you obviously have things that are in, like, you know, Steve was saying, in the wheelhouse. But it's bringing an event that has a, you know, really uniqueness to it, i.e. like Quidditch, it gets folks like yourself going, maybe I should explore that. It sounds different. It sounds unique. And then it engages the local sector to then see what it is. And the next thing you know, you have a USSSA World Series type of event that blossoms out of it. So sometimes you have to go put the game plan and get something grassroots and small and evolve it over time. And that's one of the things that this area is so great at, is going out and taking the risk on a product that has a lot of potential and figuring out how to meld that ball so that it delivers, you know, the visitors to the area, creates the economic, you know, impact that we're all looking for. Because when it's all said and done, the more activities that we do that bring visitors to this region and to the state of Maryland, you know, we love Delaware, we love Pennsylvania, we love Virginia, we love states that come here and they spend money here, because those are new dollars to the state of Maryland that we can circulate back so that the residents here can have a better quality of life using better park, you know, recreation and park facilities, using better amenities, because these tournaments leave those dollars behind so that we, the taxpayers of the state of Maryland, don't have to execute a larger bill in order to build new facilities, support current facilities, and also continue to amend and attach the right amenities and attractions that draw those people to town to give them that world-class experience.
I want to, by the way, explore the idea about Steve, about the cost to any community of these kinds of events. Obviously, we had all the great debates about stadiums and so on that have gone on. But what in terms of the cost of putting these things on vis-a-vis the kind of income you're getting, what are you looking at there?
In terms of cost to the taxpayer, as far as tourism goes, there's none. We're completely funded by hotel room tax and money that we generate. So things like the USSSA World Series, you know, we enter into agreement with the World Series, but it doesn't cost the taxpayer per se anything because that runs through our tourism mechanism. So, but there is investment when you talk about infrastructure and you talk about the things like a park system that if you don't have those types of amenities and you don't have, even Andy mentioned the things like, you know, Purdue Stadium, we held an opening ceremony out at Purdue Stadium in the first week. And when you have those types of assets, there is a public investment in those types of things that if you don't have that type of thing, people aren't going to come and certainly not going to stay and continue to stay as we've seen with USSSA. So I don't know if that addressed your question completely, but
I think it adds on though, Steve, that also adds to the legacy of the event. You host this event hoping there's going to be a leave behind for the citizens and the residents of this area. And one of the things, you know, that Steve is alluding to is that when you continue to go after events like this and the dollars build back, it allows to create the infrastructure that you as a local citizen get to take advantage of the other 300 plus days a year that when that tournament isn't in town. So the enhancements that you see going into Purdue Stadium, the enhancements that you see going into the Civic Center, those are all things that are helping the quality of life to the residents of Salisbury, the residents of Wicomico County and the Lower Eastern Shore, because these events are giving us the revenues needed to make those amenity modifications. If we didn't have those events, those things would be on a timetable that, you know, you might not see in your lifetime or mine. But because we have these events, we're getting to do them in a more expedited fashion because there are new dollars being developed in the region.
Andy, as a member of the Sports Association, how significant are these infrastructure issues? When you go out, do you find that communities you might look at, either do they have to have this infrastructure, or do you contact them and then they say perhaps, well, we're going to do X, Y, and Z, and they come back to you? What's that like? Because obviously there's a certain amount of expansion that goes on in terms of the sites that you plan.
Yeah, I mean, infrastructure is critical, especially the playing fields. At the end of the day, the game is played between the white lines, and that's what the people are coming here for. Many communities, as Terry mentioned, are not only are they investing in salespeople, but they're investing in facilities. There are new parks going up all over the state of Maryland, and there are ambitions to utilize those facilities for not necessarily this event, but other events like it, in order to maximize the potential of those facilities. And it's really a win-win. We're a traveling sideshow. We hit the road, and this week we're in Wicomico, and next week we're in Howard, and the week after we're in Montgomery, and what we look for is a community that's willing to say, you know what, on these dates you can have this, and we can complement the local user with what you're doing, but never have we had a conversation about circumventing the local user or anything like that. But yet all the improvements, all the investments that the communities make to attract and retain events like this, the local user is benefiting from 7 days a week when it's not allocated for an event like this.
So now, okay, obviously, we do have this World Series, I guess it is, but you have like sub-events that you then go mm-hmm. from to talk to other towns about then?
Our particular program, we cover the state of Maryland and Delaware. We run events from the last week in March through through Halloween weekend. With the exception of the month of August, there's a seasonal transition there where teams are kind of reforming. But we're doing probably an average of 80 to 120 teams a weekend in various parts of the two states, several in Wicomico, Ocean City, Worcester, as well as plenty on the Western Shore.
Mm. By the way, also before we go here, Terry, I wanted to ask you about the Dew Tour.
Yes.
He was here for a few years. Matter of fact, I think we covered the last year that it was here. So what happened? How did it get attracted to the area? But then what happened about its departure?
Well, the attraction to the area, I have to, in full essence, take full credit for that. I worked the first Dew Tour on record in Louisville, Kentucky, back when I was in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and kept a relationship with the Dew Tour folks throughout the reiterations. That the Dew Tour revamps itself every couple of years. You know, they go to a little different model, trying to, you know, identify other destinations. And we had a very good run here with the Dew Tour. We set all the attendance records associated with the Dew Tour. You know, the beachfront property gave them a chance to expose, you know, new sports and the like. But like I said, every several years, they have to go through a transformational stage. You know, they have to narrow down. They bring out the vert ramp, and they bring out these things into individual sport components. And they have to go where they see the bigger sponsorship dollars, and also where there's trending in the various sports. And what happened with us is they needed to transform that model because they needed to get back into an arena with a couple of their sports. They also wanted to get a high exposure opportunity because it's a made for television event. So, you know, they're now, I forget what, you know, city it is, but they're on the street going down this major street, you know, downtown with the big tall skyscrapers in the background. So every 3 or 4 years, they go through an evolution, and we had a very good run for it. And in all fairness, it probably had run its course. You know, we would have probably saw some diminishing returns after that third year, but we had a great experience. It brought a lot of exposure to, you know, to the lower Eastern Shore. It continues to bring a lot of exposure because, you know, as you notice, the Dew Tour runs their program throughout the year. And we're very proud to be a part of that. And we know that we're first and foremost on their mind when it comes back to their next reiteration of, you know, bringing it back. But that's a sport because of the niche of the various components of action sports. They need to take on, you know, what's in the best interest of their company profile. And that's really what happened. It was not that we did anything wrong or we exposed them in a wrong way. They still brag about Ocean City and its capability that we brought 100,000+ people to the event. So we are foremost on their radar. But like I said, we have to understand, and Steve understands it. And there's sometimes your business needs to, you know, make transitions in order to capture a better attendance market or capture a better financial market. And that's what the Dew Tour had to go through.
And did you go through the same process with some of your big events, or
we do
shift, or how does it work?
We do. We're especially on the weekend events, we're consistently reinventing ourselves. And this World Series reinvents the off the field components every year. I mean, we literally sit with Steve's team for about an 8 or 9 hour meeting, it seems. And go through every little component and figure out how we can tweak it. And because we are seeing return visitors for it, and we want to give them a quality experience, but a different experience. We don't want them to know the script completely. With these events, the bottom line is if they're mutually beneficial and the customers are satisfied, at least from where our company sits, we want to keep it going. As long as we can reinvent within the confines of where we are, we're gonna stick with a good thing.
Well, as a matter of fact, Steve, does this force communities like yourself to constantly be looking out to make sure that they don't get up and leave?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, any event. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, you can't be complacent with anything. Any event like this, especially of this scope. And that's been one of the challenges for our staff as this event. We've been fortunate to grow with the event, but each year, one of the messages I preach to our staff is you can't assume this and you can't take it for granted. And the same goes for members of our community. They know that just because it has been here is something you don't take for granted. So you continue to push yourself and push your staff to, like Andy said, offer a great experience for the people that come. And we just look to build relationships and continue to try to bring folks back and give them as good experience as we can.
And I would, of course, be remiss if I didn't mention, of course, ice hockey. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of talk about it. I know that Worcester County is looking at doing it. I even read, I think, the other day where there's one of the leagues said, well, they might be interested in Wicomico County. Where is all of that in terms? I mean, is it really possible that we could wind up with ice hockey on the Eastern Shore? What do you think?
I think there is there's exploration going on right now. There is obviously a study going on in Worcester County that's being done by the Maryland Stadium Authority to explore, you know, where ice hockey fits into the global equation. I think through that study, you're seeing there's obviously a demand for some ice. The question is where is the best fit? How is it best managed? And how do we best utilize it? Should it come to fruition? And where is the best and ideal location for it? Is it a reinvention of adding ice back into this, you know, the Youth and Civic Center here? Or is it a new facility? Or is it a blend of converting something that might already exist that just needs to be tweaked and modified? So that exploration is going on right now. And hopefully sometime this fall, we'll know the answer to that question. But there is a underlying, ice community. I call it ice community because hockey is part of that. But whenever you put ice in, you then have to think about the other opportunities, i.e. figure skating, i.e. open skate opportunities, i.e. curling, and anything that uses ice. You need to have a strategy to maximize that surface, because in certain areas of the country, that surface is only down about 6 months. So what are you doing to expand it? And then also have strategies. If you put it in a place like the Youth and Civic Center, how are you covering it, periodically, so that you can do the events that you need to do, i.e. like wrestling, i.e. like basketball. And, ice takes time, and you got to mature it, you got to cultivate it. So you have to have a strategy, and all those things are being explored, discussed right now as we speak.
Because I understand, as a matter of fact, that the proposal, I guess it was by Hattrick, for Westchester County, that their vision is that it sounds as if there will be sort of this principle issue of having an ice hockey team. But then they were talking about that. But then they say, but then you have to have like an expanded sports complex so that it's not just completely dependent upon ice events. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that what we're really looking at?
Well, one of the, there's actually two ways that it's being looked at. It's looking at, ice, and the need and how that would be utilized. And then if they did, what would be the other things that would be necessary to order enhance that experience and that expenditure? And one of the discussions is, okay, if they do it, do you need to put on that expansive, additional component? Well, is it a public skate, additional piece of ice? Is it a ball field or linear field complex that needs to go and coincide with it? Because at the end of the day, when you put ice down and it were to be in a new facility, it goes into a shell. And how do you use that shell other times when the ice is not down? So there's a lot of moving parts to how this has to be evaluated. It has to be a lot of people engaged in it. It also has to take into consideration what's already in the marketplace. Right now, we're talking about, an event that's going on here right now in the World Series. We're talking about the other, extensive activities that are going on. And does it make sense to, like I said, renovate and put it in something that already exists? And if that's the right avenue, how do you get it done? Who pays for it? And, how long are we waiting until we first see that first piece of ice? I don't have the answer to that, but the study in the future will tell us.
Hmm. Steve, by the way, just sort of following in on that, some people, by the way, have suggested it may perhaps the Wacomico Center, now that it can, as a matter of fact, I guess, sell alcohol, might be an ideal place. I'm curious about your impression, about your sense about that, and whether or not if indeed they build, say, another sports complex, it might be centered around ice hockey, but they say, we're going to have other kinds of things, perhaps even baseball fields. There might be some competition that you might wind up having if, say something is built in Worcester as opposed to here?
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility, but, like Terry said, we'll wait to see what the study reveals, and we're content with that. But I think for our part, one of the special things about our partnership called MASA is that there are assets in each of these communities, being Worcester County, Ocean City, and ourselves. And so if there is a sports complex built, what we would try to do, as opposed to directly competing, we'd try to leverage that as a region we have more to be able to attract bigger and better events. So as far as the hockey piece goes, again, we're content to see what evolves out of the study. But for our part, we're exploring all opportunities, and certainly you mentioned the alcohol piece that potentially could open itself to franchise opportunities, and we're exploring all of that, but we'll see what the future holds here.
We are speaking with Terry Haseltine. He's was appointed head of Maryland Sports, which encourages the development of sporting events around the state. Also, Steve Miller, he's director of the Wacomico County Recreation Parks and Tourism, and Andy Wisk, he's the program director of the U.S. Specialty Sports Association. I appreciate all of you stopping by and talking with us.
Well, we appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.